Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 17 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons, and I thank you very much for tuning into the podcast on your various electronic devices. This week, I spoke to my friend Justin Rogers Cooper, who, as usual, helps me sort out some of the insane things that are going on the global landscape right now. The number one issue would be Syria, obviously, and the possible military strike that apparently Obama wants to get started on, but has thrown to Congress and is now in the midst of attempting diplomacy. There's been a lot of different angles, a lot of discussion, a lot of chaotic thinking about it, about what the motivations behind all this might be. So I think Justin had a few really compelling thoughts, and we had a great discussion about Syria. We also talked about Edward Snowden and the revelations regarding the NSA. Obviously, Justin had a lot to say about that. And we wrapped up talking about the recent mayoral primary in New York City, in which Bill de Blasio won a pretty big statement victory against the status quo of Mayor Bloomberg, and particularly a rebuke to the policies of stop and frisk that have been a big subject of discussion on this show. So Justin and I had a great discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Just a note, I know it's been a while since I've put one of these episodes out there, but I was in California, and I kind of, you know, got lost in the haze of California summertime, and now I am back in New York City and ready to discuss the pressing issues of our time. And so I hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll excuse my end of the conversation, at least sound-wise, in which there's a little bit of distortion on my voice. I think it's fine. I think it doesn't sound too bad, but I'm working on that, and I know I'm an amateur at this, but I'm trying. All right, Justin, it's been a long time since we've done this. I'm really excited to catch up with you and try and figure out what's going on in the world, because it seems like confusion is part of the global narrative right now. There's a lot of confusion on it seems like all sides, including, I would say, among the American public about what's going on. Obviously, the big thing that's in the headlines right now is Syria. I want to talk to you a little bit about Syria, but also, you know, we had a show about stop and frisk, which has been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court since last we spoke, and a few other major turnarounds in the economy and other big stories. So thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's always great to be here. I'm probably going to sound a little nasally, and I have a bit of a cough, so just excuse me in advance. I'm recovering from one of these late summer illnesses.
Do you think that's related to climate change at all?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's got to be.
Oh, definitely.
Either that or, like, yeah. I don't know, some sort of CIA thing. maybe both. Maybe they're the same thing. So, Syria. I think that the narrative about Syria is really interesting. I mean, for a million different reasons. But you know, for me, I've been interested in kind of seeing the evolution of war policy since the Bush administration, since 9/11. There's been obviously a kind of acceleration in a phenomenon that had been going on for a while, that is the concentration of war powers in the executive. And to see Obama kind of take this tack at the last minute, apparently, of throwing it to the Congress is an interesting kind of political gamble. I'm not exactly sure where he's going with that. It definitely, I have to say, it threw me when he announced it. And what we've seen in the week since that announcement has been, I would say, the main story is how nobody seems to A, understand the Syrian problem, or B, in support of U.S. military intervention. So where does this put us?
Well, I think metaphorically and literally, you could say that Syria is an intelligence failure. And I think that that's an intelligence failure on Obama, meaning his personal intelligence has failed, congressional intelligence has failed. I think the intelligence is flawed from the beginning, and I think that that's partly why the mainstream media in any different sector of the global media, meaning Europe has a different narrative, United States has a different narrative, the Middle East has a different narrative, Israel has a different narrative,
right?
China and Russia.
Israel literally said nothing for 4 or 5 days. Literally said nothing for 4 or 5 days after Obama's announcement, yep. And it seemed like there was kind of almost an ideological paralysis around this issue. Yep. What is going on for someone who's kind of has a basic understanding of things in the Middle East? What is happening?
Well, there's a lot happening, and I think that I just want to get back to one thing about Obama, which is his decision to seek congressional approval is a bit of a Hail Mary maneuver, unless there's some other factor involved that we need to think through. But on the surface of it, it's a Hail Mary maneuver, in part because the strategic fallout, the political fallout, the popular fallout from a bombing campaign within, let's say, the first 7 days, if he had just gone ahead and bombed 55 targets over 3 days, and we had seen protests spontaneously organized in most American cities and hand-wringing in the Democratic Party, on the one hand, the military goals might have been accomplished to the limited extent that those strikes would have been punitive. And second of all, you know, there's going to be fallout no matter what from this. And he's already taken a huge hit on his credibility, on his legitimacy, from his own party, the American public. So, I mean, it was a lose-lose situation from the beginning. But in this, by going this route, assuming that he genuinely wants an intervention, which from all appearances,
he or the powers that
right.
control him.
Well, or the powers that the powers that he's
I shouldn't say the powers
with.
That control him the right. The powers that that have power,
his true influence
in shifting his perspective on this. This is the thing that kind of that puzzles me about the whole thing. I know that the intentions of the United States are not humanitarian, and I think that just goes without saying. I mean, we could go into a long history of the United States foreign interventions,
right?
And particularly the last 15 to 20 years of intervention in the Middle East,
right.
As evidence of that.
Right.
So if we toss that out, even though he's kind of framing it in those terms, what are the real motivations for U.S. intervention here?
Well, it's a confusing situation.
Why is Obama so driven? I mean, I think it would be confusing to people, and I would say, like, you know, I don't want to stereotype or make it a monolithic group, but like the typical American liberal, right? Middle class liberal. They voted for Obama mainly because they were repulsed by 8 years of Bush and that kind of rogue war making strategies. So, with Obama elected as that kind of anti-war candidate, isn't it confusing to see him so driven by this? Because if most Americans, if that typical American liberal can't understand the war in Syria and really doesn't feel any kind of real drive to intervene militarily, then how is it that Obama is so driven?
Well, it's a really complicated question. I think it's the right question, though, because I do not think this is about humanitarian intervention or punitive strikes against the Assad regime for this purported use of chemical weapons. That's just not that's not the main factor. And so there has to be, at the very least, an alternative or parallel set of factors that are influencing this administration's policy that are maybe hovering at the margins of conversation, but maybe are the windows into a sort of different room of thought within the administration, within the kind of higher powers that sort of are in the executive branch and are networked into the executive branch that want this. Now, I agree with you, though, that they want this very badly. Here's how badly they want it. In today's New York Times, on the article about rallying for the Syrian vote,
right,
we learn that the only other time the administration has mobilized this level of support to try to influence public opinion was for healthcare policy. So just that statement alone, when you look at the Obama era, in hindsight, the two things they most wanted were healthcare and this bombing.
Right,
and so
right.
When you look at the signature Obamacare policy as the output of countless hours of negotiations with lobbyists, healthcare, the push in the corporate media. I mean, right now, Obama literally is going to every single news channel, network and cable. They're all taping interviews. He's going to be on TV on Tuesday night, just making the case to the American public. And it's going to be the equivalent of his Philadelphia race speech, such as that is,
yes,
for a different topic. He's going to put the full weight of his presidency behind this particular thing.
It's really interesting.
Is it really logical to assume that he's doing all of this to punish a regime for chemical weapons that were supplied to that regime, not only by, you know, the Soviets and some of the kind of non-Western counterparties and in the international scene. It was supplied to them, as we learned from another article in today's Times, by Western firms, including firms right here in the United States.
It's a weird stand to take for Obama.
It's an extremely bizarre stand to take. And so I think we should speculate what's really behind this.
I mean, it reminds me of the little the small, I don't know, proxy battles of the Cold War. It reminds me of Vietnam a little bit, in terms of it's a kind of, there is a kind of a pattern in recent American history of liberals fighting these small wars for supposedly humanitarian purposes. I'm thinking of Bill Clinton's intervention in Kosovo. Do you think that's like the right comparison to make, that there's a kind of like a weird liberal belief or need to own war in a way that is a positive force?
Yeah, and I'll apologize.
A progressive force.
I apologize in advance, because I also don't think that war was about its stated purposes either. When you look at what the NATO supply lines were doing in Kosovo at the time, two things come to mind. One, in that war, in terms of the breakdown of the Yugoslav nation state and the subsequent proxy battles that were fought not only by the United States, but also fought, remember, by Al-Qaeda.
So right.
That war also involved weapons supplied by the U.S. to Al-Qaeda, which, you know, is part of the murkiness of the current Syrian conflict. That is a parallel that no one has mentioned in the New York Times articles. But what's also interesting is that when you look to see what were the repercussions of the U.S. occupations after Milosevic left power, that became a major pipeline for drug running from Central Asia into Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And NATO supply lines, whether purposely or not, ended up fostering a security environment that made it possible for the emergence of black market economies to more easily funnel large amounts of untraceable cash related to the drug industry straight from Central Asia to Western Europe. That's part of the deep politics behind that. That's not conspiracy.
That's probably
it's actually out there.
The last season of The Wire that they didn't make.
Yeah, I'm not saying that was the reason for the intervention either.
Sure.
I'm just saying that was one of the byproducts. Now, when we look at this intervention for Syria, then it's never really a question of liberal humanitarian motives. That's public opinion stuff. And what they really miffed the public opinion narrative for the whole Syria thing.
Well, that's what I was, you know, just reading about the Vietnam War a lot, that Johnson was really, really reluctant to ever sell the Vietnam War to the American public, because he knew that it was hard to wrap up. It was hard to explain in a way that the American public would see the war as necessary. So it seems like a big gamble in a way for Obama, especially you know, the Republicans, for whatever reason, had this giant gift with 9/11 happening right at the beginning of the Bush administration. And so Bush had a really clear international narrative handed to him that he could exploit and send, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops to the Middle East without too much of an uproar in the on the American public.
Yep.
So, but now is you know, we're in different times. We're in uncharted territory here, and so with Obama stepping forth, like you're saying, to start talking to us about Syria, what emotional tones is he going to strike? What kind of chords can he play inside the American public to make them see their own interests in Syria, when we're sitting here living during a time of, you know, really nearly unprecedented economic disaster? How can Americans attach any kind of value to intervention in Syria when they're trying to figure out how they're going to pay the bills?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, I would say a third of Americans are struggling, and the country's been divided up into, you know, three sets. We can talk about that later.
Right.
But as far as his personal pitch, he's a creative and imaginative, you know, rhetorical thinker. So I'll give him credit for coming up with something that I'm not going to be able to come up with. But here's what I've taken from the situation already. The reason why the whole Syrian intervention thing has failed is the reason why Americans don't get upset when they read about so-called inner-city violence, which is, this is not a country that mobilizes itself on the basis of brown people killing other brown people, especially Muslims. Can you imagine? We want to look at the Republican anti-war crowd who's turning the House Republicans against the Obama intervention. And we want to say, hey, you know, maybe they're war weary, which is the polite way that the New York Times has framed it. Well, there's another way to look at it, which is Muslims killing Muslims is not an emotional card that's going to work on Americans,
right,
particularly white Americans and middle-class swing voting suburbs. That's not going to play. And so why should we intervene on the moral charge that Muslims are dying,
yeah,
but not Americans? So
right,
the one thing Obama has to do if he wants to make this speech effective is to tie white American security into what's happening in Syria. That's what Bush did with WMD in Iraq. It was very actually successful in that he was able to at least administer a basic majority. 50-55% of Americans believed that Saddam was going to transfer weapons to Al-Qaeda that he already had, which, you know, all this is...
And that the next warning we might get would come in the form of a,
exactly,
if I remember Bush's words, a mushroom cloud,
exactly,
over a major American city. So
exactly.
You know, Obama did did not use as aggressive of a language as saying that, you know, we could have a nuclear bomb going off in an American city here. But in the speech he made the other day when he announced that he was sending this to Congress, he did make reference to chemical weapons, which is really the whole issue here, right?
Right.
Chemical weapons have crossed some sort of red line that the United States and the UN have,
right,
have agreed upon, that the use of chemical weapons is just beyond the pale, and that Obama did make some sort of reference to the idea that if we allow this to go unchallenged, then we're going to see these kinds of attacks increase, we're going to see more of an acceptance of the use of chemical weapons. What I don't understand is that, well, maybe I do understand, but I'd like to just bring it up,
mm-hmm,
is that how the United States can say this stuff with a straight face when the United States has been, you know, using white phosphorus, committing
Agent Orange,
committing war crimes on the level of what many would describe as genocidal in the Middle East for the last 20 years. How can the United States sit here and say that not only that the United States should judge the humanitarian principles of warfare, but the United States should intervene when others are using the same kinds of heinous tools of warfare that the United States uses on a regular basis?
I'm not going to question the logic of that. I'm just going to say that it's not accepted in mainstream storytelling of American families that the United States even used white phosphorus in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they did. There's all the proof there. It was widely covered in, say, the Australian media, which is where I read up most of my stories about that. And we look at the carcinogenic impacts on places like Fallujah, the birth defects, the babies being born.
Depleted uranium?
Well, that too. That, you know, that's a separate but related story.
Yeah, I mean, you could go on and on.
But when you look at it, no, people don't know about this. There's not reports of this in the mainstream media. These aren't policy points that any administration has hit ever.
Mm.
And this isn't talking points that come down from corporate editors. And this there's no interest that any branch of the United States government and its affiliated corporate allies have in pressing forward with that claim, which means that most people don't. Most people don't even know about it. So,
right.
You know, that's the way that I would answer that question. There,
we're having a little bit of a sound problem. It's our headphones that are the problem, Justin.
Okay.
We're still recording everything. I'm just trying to fix it.
That's a shame for our listeners.
So what's amazing to me about that, what you're saying, is that most Americans don't know about what kinds of weapons the United States has been using in the Middle East, and what kind of dastardly record the United States has in these military interventions. So if that's true, then most Americans accept the United States as some kind of some sort of like moral global authority, right?
That's absolutely correct. And you know, I think Americans do accept that during Vietnam some really horrible things happened. And I just think that what makes the United States interesting, and this probably is true for most of the Western powers the last 75 years, no international body or other nation state has ever held the United States
accountable for
anything.
Well, I mean, we can go all the way back to World War II in terms of the United States kind of solidifying its global authority with the UN creating... The history of the United States behavior in the UN, and particularly invoking its veto power as a member of the Security Council, it tells the story how the United States has maintained global power since World War II.
And there was an incredible passing moment, if you recall, when Obama took power in 2008, his first term. And he actually had to say out loud, "I will not be prosecuting the former administration for war crimes."
Right.
But, like, that moment tells you everything about this one.
So how does he sell it? How is this going to work? Are we going to, you think there's going to be a trick pulled out and we're going to, all of a sudden I'm going to be eating my words next week as I sign up to go fight in Syria?
No, I don't think any of us will do that. But I also don't think, I want to think like a Vulcan about it here for a second, which means I'm going to divorce myself emotionally from, you know, all these different contexts and from myself, even as a citizen.
Think like a Kissinger.
Just think like a Kissinger. And
a realist.
Yeah. And
that's what we call it. In diplomacy, we call that realism.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that this is what's going to happen. I'd have to be an idiot to say that. But I'm just saying, if you wanted to manufacture public opinion, you'd have to do a few things. One, go McCarthy. You'd have to say that there are terrorist cells in the United States affiliated with Hezbollah under the orders of Assad who already have chemical weapons inside the country, and you need to pull out a piece of intelligence that's domestically oriented. And if you want to save the NSA for a moment, you can just say, we got it from the NSA and the FBI working together. They followed. We have three cells. We know they're in the United States. This is what I said to you earlier. You got to go homeland.
Right.
You got to do a Claire Danes.
And it would be nice to connect.
It's showtime.
But it would be nice to connect the usefulness and the practicality of all the NSA stuff and be like, in your face, Edward Snowden.
That's right.
Look what we just did. Not only did we foil an attack on the U.S. soil, but we also gave a perfect kind of justification for intervening with the military in Syria.
That's right. I mean, if anyone thinks that any government is ever capable of what we call false flag events, you know, like intelligence created or intelligence acknowledged opportunities where you can sway public opinion using various forms of violence, real or imagined, this is the moment for the McCarthyism. This is the moment to really pull out a Willie Horton moment. You got to identify an enemy inside the country. Here's another thing you could do. If you have the means and capabilities, and again, you don't care about human life, you let off a chemical weapon attack in the United States now, you know, as a preemptive move from the Syrian government to say that they're already responding.
The timing would seem a bit obvious.
Obvious timing. Another thing you could do is to let off a gas attack inside of Israel.
And right, then
you would need images of Western-looking people suffering that are non-Muslims.
Mm.
You know, of course, you know. So I'm just saying that this is really...
Applying the Alex Jones razor to diplomatic relations.
And again, I'm just saying that would stir the kind of emotional hysteria.
But it tells you where the fact that we're sitting here kind of speculating about what it would take to get Obama to be able to really sell this war to the American public lets us know a little bit of where the American public is at. I mean, from what I'm reading today, senators, Congress, men and women are getting nothing but negative attitude towards this war from their constituents.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's really interesting because Obama tried to, I think, and I may be reading this the wrong way, but it seems like the Hail Mary, as you call it, of throwing it to Congress, is kind of a nod to 2008 Obama, which is the idea that he's going to bring the notion of democracy back to war making in the United States that was supposedly robbed from us by the Bush administration. Although, you know, I must say that the executive has been running war. The executive along with the State Department has been running war away from the interest and input of the American public basically forever. So it's kind of weird to kind of place that as a recent phenomenon, and probably part of the larger kind of problem with the left and particularly liberalism right now is still focusing on Bush as the anomalous kind of moment in particularly in foreign policy, when it seems that Bush was kind of the maybe the apex or the acceleration even of policies that have been in place and strategies that have been playing out for decades.
Three things on that. Number one, the Republican that created the national security state was Abraham Lincoln, not George Bush. You know, that's just a fact. Number two,
Civil War is the first industrial war,
and that's when the executive power gained everything that it would later claim, and that continues to be expanded today. Number two, you're right. This is a post Tea Party, post Occupy moment. We're seeing a different strand of American politics. Maybe the reason Obama goes to Congress is because the kind of ruling political financial elite, so to speak, have decided that actually American public opinion is so anti-Washington, so anti-government from both sides.
So anti-bank
and so anti, in some ways, anti-centralized decision-making, that they've had to sort of run this back through the chain of democratic command to see if they can do anything with it, because they actually don't know what would happen domestically if they just went ahead and did the spontaneous bombing thing. So I think that's possibly true. I also think that what this tells us is that we're in a post 9/11 moment. The very fact that we had to do Alec Jones McCarthyism Vulcan war planning is in part because the 9/11 narrative is played out emotionally.
Yes.
And to the extent that the Syrian stuff is even related to that, which it borrows from Iraq and Afghanistan, and in some ways it what it lacks is 9/11. That's why we were talking about false flag events and terrorist attacks.
There's no gasoline left in the 9/11 engine anymore.
There's none left. Yeah. And it kind of brings me back to one last additional point. Gosh, that's such an interesting thing, the idea that the American public might have actually commanded more power through the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street in the last few years than even the American public now recognizes.
Right, right.
A couple of things to think about. One, Obama's approval ratings are terrible going into this.
Mm-hmm.
30s. So, he was elected in November. I mean, I don't know how you go from 53% in the country to 38% or whatever it was a few weeks ago. I might be exaggerating a little bit.
It's actually surprising how unpopular he is.
If he did this without congressional approval, actually, you probably don't get any of your domestic agenda done for your entire second term, at least until the congressional elections next year.
Yeah.
So, actually, maybe this is the only way to salvage what's already a dead second term. Even this is like the salvage yard aspect of it. The other thing that I want to say here, just to go back to one point we were making, is any kind of true motivation here. If you look at Afghanistan and Iraq and the stuff that's been going on with Iran and Egypt and everything else, it's very clear the United States wants friendly governments in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And they still want friendly governments in the Middle East. So
from what I understand, that's the narrative that makes most sense to me, is that the players outside of Syria, the players that have interest in Syria, that is Russia and Iran and China and the United States, they're interested in it because they're confused by it. They don't know which side is going to win. Syria has devolved into what most would describe as a civil war now. So much like situations we've seen in other countries over the last few decades, you have these larger powers, whether they be imperial powers or the powers of globalized capital or whatever. These outside powers, outside states, are interested because they're not sure how it's going to turn out, and they want to be on the right side. They want to make sure that Obama has basically stated as much, and so it seems like that's what explains why there's not a whole lot of conviction on either side, because it's really an early point in a it's kind of like the opening. The opening rounds in a game of Risk. If you used to play Risk,
I play Risk all
right?
the time.
And so the opening rounds of Risk are really kind of, and even the opening rounds in a game of chess, to make it even simpler, are really chaotic and confusing. You're setting it up, and it seems like that's where we're at with Syria, which is really interesting. It's like we're starting over in the Middle East, at least ideologically, after the disaster of the Iraq War and Afghanistan. The United States isn't pulling out, though. The United States is kind of signaling we're still in charge here. And it seems like, past the humanitarian motivation, it seems like Obama, what he's saying and is kind of scary, is that we're not going for regime change here. We're not really taking a side on this even. We just want to let everyone know that we're in the game and that we have a level of authority here. Like, basically, I just want to throw some bombs to show who's boss here.
Yeah, this is a Soprano moment.
Definitely.
And I agree that it comes at an opportune time after Iraq and Afghanistan.
It's mafia type behavior. That's what. Just to clarify your Soprano comment.
But let's also be clear that the Middle East is a strategic necessity for the U.S.
Right,
global
right.
empire.
I mean, that's how I've always understood it. And it's not as simple as we're going to Syria to take their oil. It's more about just keep maintaining a lever of power there, and we pick countries to be friendly to. It actually kind of tells you a little bit about. I think the Syria case is a nice study in global politics,
because
it kind of lets you know that the United States isn't as simple as maybe an ordinary the typical liberal that we always parody on this show that believes that Bush was the most evil wager of war in the Middle East. it kind of gives the lie to that. It kind of says the United States isn't just nonstop force. The United States has to play a certain kind of game. And Obama at this point is entering into a game that the United States has participated in. And I don't want to use the phrases or the won or lost, because I think it's kind of been you could go either way on that, but the United States is signaling that they're still very much in the game.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of controlling things in the Middle East.
And we can't doubt for a second the strategic imperative of what Iran means to the Middle East. And it's even all the humanitarian stuff, by the way, is just rhetorical stuff that's for public opinion. That's what it is. That's Americans are by definition, they want to see themselves as moral people.
Right.
They need moral arguments. Yes. But strategic objectives has nothing to do with moral arguments. And Iran, in part, is a strategic object, not because it's going to take its nuclear weapons and give them to terrorists. It's because in a world of insecurity, in a world where you don't know what's coming around the corner, you need options, the way that people have stock options. You need the strategic possibility of overtaking countries that are sitting on extremely valuable natural resources.
Right.
And that's the thing with Iran. That's why if they actually stopped making the bomb and everyone was convinced of that, there might not be the necessary push for regime change. As long as they make that bomb, though, the reason why that bomb is an asset, it's not because they're going to deliver it to terrorists. It's because it ruins the poker hand the U.S. has over the third largest strategic oil reserves left that are proven. In a world where we don't need them, we don't just need to get to them now. We want to be able to get to them in the event of an emergency or a total war scenario, World War III type scenario that isn't likely. But on the off chance that anything develops, you have a nation whose military is the largest consumer of oil in the world. That's the U.S. Mm-hmm. military. We don't need the Iranian oil. We just want to be able to have it.
Right.
And so if you look at it that way and you really think, wow. And if the military is guaranteeing the entire American empire as we know it, if what's left, what's to come, etc., you need the gas that makes that empire go, which is oil. And to that extent, Syria is about oil. It's not about, like, we're going to take the oil and we're going to send it to Americans so they're SUVs.
Right,
that's
right.
Not it. It's about getting it into the supply chain and having the option to get it into the supply chain. And I just want to say one other thing about that, which is... no, go ahead.
It's interesting because it seems like that narrative about Bush is just going to Iraq to take oil for SUVs. It seems like things have become more complex, and I wonder if that's it reminds me of notions of postmodernism in culture, right? That there's things get infinitely more complex, and there are layers of awareness that build almost genetically as we move forward through history. And I don't know if that's true, but it seems like with the enormous amount of skepticism that the American public is receiving this information with about Syria interests me, because it does seem like that there is kind of there seems to be a growing understanding that the United States is enmeshed in something much more complex than that. And it's not just about electing the right guy from Texas that might steal the oil or not, but it's really a matrix of forces that the United States is involved in.
I agree with that, except that I would say it was always that complicated, at least during the Bush era.
Yeah.
There is no...
No, I'm talking about cultural understanding. Yeah. I'm not talking about how it actually is. I agree with you. Yeah. I think there's more of continuity.
You're right.
I think it's just about kind of an understanding.
And I think that continuity is essential to understanding this situation and every previous one and everyone to follow. And I think that there is no such thing as the villain named George W. Bush.
Right.
And there is no such thing as the hero or the villain named Barack Obama. These guys don't exist. And the reason that they are even there, so we can obsess about their personalities like some sort of celebrity worship, is strictly to give us all the emotional gratification of pretending that we make important policy choices as people in a democracy. We have an influence over the personnel.
Yeah.
But as you see with his nomination of Summers or his possible nomination of
the
Summers,
The
project remains the same.
Yeah.
And so what we need to believe and what the media tells us to believe is that Obama and Bush create these policies and weigh them out like they're the top of the chain.
Yeah.
And this architecture about the mythology of the power of the U.S. president is both real in the sense of the presidency as a legal entity that, as part of the executive branch / national security state, is able to be the lawless enforcer that commits these acts and is able to produce these events and take responsibility for them and is allowed to by the judicial branch and the legislative branch. That's why the president's necessary as a legal maneuver, but as an object of public fantasy, the presidency plays a very important role in sustaining the belief that we're all participating in a democracy.
Yeah.
And we are, but not in the ways that we think we are. And what's important about Syria is we are participating in democracy simply by saying to those representatives, no, we don't want the war with Syria. That's the reason he threw it back to Congress, potentially. That's what's important to realize about this situation. But that's not an election.
Right,
you
right.
Know? And so what it tells us about the complexity in the matrix, the situation you're acknowledging here, is that what's most important here, in a weird way, is our belief system and not who we put into office. The only way to change the system going forward, and we've said this before,
is to change our beliefs, change the laws, change the internal cultural structures,
and the actual administration of the branches of government. Mm-hmm. We need new laws
that reflect those cultural
and
changes.
And we need new ways to enforce current laws.
Right, right.
We do not need new people. New people will not save this system. The system's been permanently corrupted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Elections will not transform the democracy.
I agree with you.
Whatever way we go forward, it's not going to be through elections, and Obama has proven that.
Well, one signal that might be cited as proof of that is the treatment of Edward Snowden, which I wanted to get to. Edward Snowden, obviously the dude of the summer, in terms of capturing the imagination of a lot of people in government, the American public, the media, the global media. Snowden is part of a larger trend, though, I would say. Obviously, Chelsea Manning, who recently has been known for most of her time in the public as Bradley Manning, she has now been convicted and sentenced, and I think the American government would like to get their hands on Snowden in the same way. So, what is happening with that? How important is what Snowden revealed?
Everything in terms of the digital surveillance crises that have happened this summer, and in that I would include Steubenville rapes in Ohio, I would include the Chelsea Manning court case, mm-hmm. I would include the Snowden events, and I would go back to WikiLeaks. Is extremely important for telling us a lot about how our culture has changed since the internet. And the most important context I have for putting this through is to get people to understand that the remnants of a very fundamentalist and violent rape culture, which is not, I would say, how I would describe the majority of American culture, but how I would describe a kind of rump demographic that's mm-hmm. left over from our period of anti-civil rights, lynching, and slavery. This culture, this is the same one that articulated marriage as a form of slavery and articulated women as objects and as property. This is the rump populist part of that culture. This is the culture that rapes people and puts it on video and then is convicted on the basis of that. This culture has been transformed into a digital culture.
Mm.
And what makes Chelsea Manning, for me, just so exceptional as a way to begin this conversation, is that she has been judicially lynched, you know, forgive the term.
Mm-hmm.
She's been court-martialed, scapegoated, put into prison for whistleblowing, and one of the key symbolic events that she whistleblowed on was the murder of those Reuters journalists by the soldiers in the helicopter.
Right.
Who, you know, this was on Live Leak, et cetera.
Yeah,
who mowed down those journalists.
Yes.
What we saw there.
She exposed war crimes.
She exposed
murder.
And it was, I think,
state sanctioned murder.
And I would say that murder is rape.
Yeah.
And I would say that when you listen to the sadism and the glee that was communicated as a homosocial form of sociality between those soldiers killing the journalists and killing the children and killing the whole suspected militants.
And laughing while they're doing
laughing
it.
Laughing while they're doing it. That's the rape culture right there. So you can have a rape culture without actual sexual sodomizing, but it blends so easily with the destruction of bodies and the obliteration and the murder. And here you have someone who represents what I believe to be a very important sign of the continuing political relevance of an alternative queer culture that's not about gay marriage.
Mm.
This is the other leading political edge. And I'm not saying this queer culture is responsible for anti-surveillance or whistleblowing, but I'm saying it can't be written out of this new story.
Yeah. You're taking a very grad student edge on it, which I really appreciate. Actually, is that there are things going on here that we don't often recognize that are sometimes like right in front of us. I thought the fact that Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, was a queer figure was really, really important throughout the whole trial, and it didn't really get mentioned that much, not until the very end when she herself made it an issue by kind of announcing her sexuality and announcing her gender orientation. And so it's really, really interesting to hear you say that, because I think you're right. I think there is something going on much larger than that. When you have I think it was, it's either Newsweek or U.S. News and World Report had a reporter that tweeted recently his fantasy of killing Julian Assange. I don't know if you caught that, that he had to then later like clarify or apologize. I don't know if he even apologized. Hmm. But it was a tweet that was kind of just thrown out there by a major journalist for a huge corporate newspaper or magazine, literally fantasizing about murdering Julian Assange. It's like really lets you know that there are deeper things going on here.
Yes.
Tied to nationalism, tied to what you describe as rape culture, tied to a kind of savage misogyny.
And I think that surveillance exists on a continuum with a kind of rape culture, which again, I don't think is the dominant culture, not even within the government, not even within the NSA. But I do think that the surveillance state is a state that's predicated on power and desire. The sub-story of the NSA thing that came out 2 weeks ago is that there's an actual term called like love intel or something, that the NSA has so many people inside of its institution spying on ex-lovers, on objects of desire, getting life stories and background history on potential dating targets and potential ex-lovers, etc., that's part of the culture. In other words, there you have it intertwined together, that the abuse of power that we understand to be surveillance abuse is tied into the desire to know, what literary authors called epistemophilia, the love of knowing, the love of uncovering, the thing that makes you want to finish the film or finish the novel. Part of that human psychology is in play here, and is part of this desire to strip down the walls, to spy on other people. There's voyeuristic fantasies in play here, and they're being interwoven into complex political conversations about terrorism and about national security.
And again, if you know anything about the history of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, what you're seeing with the NSA is really not surprising in terms of the will to do this kind of surveillance and this kind of broad power grab. But at the same time, the level of it and the fact that we are all living a kind of information heavy life makes it really, really interesting to me that we're at this moment. I wanted to throw something at you, because you, as we realize that the government is acting in this kind of brutal, dystopic, paranoid, technocratic way, it makes me think of I just watched a comedian named Doug Stanhope on Netflix last night, and he's got a new special, and he was talking about Occupy Wall Street and how disappointed he was that Occupy Wall Street didn't take it further. He was disappointed that they didn't storm the banks and really do something other than sit in a park, as he was kind of riffing on that idea. But what he said is that he read a book about Scientology, and what he learned from Scientology is that a guy named L. Ron Hubbard created a religion, and he created a religion in modern times, or very recently, that has like a huge following, has created enormous wealth and enormous influence around the world. And part of the way that he pulled that off is by being just a completely creating a brutal, insane, aggressive institution that went after, that aggressively pursued legal and sometimes physical punishment to anyone that stood in their way. And so he said, what I wish is that the Occupy Wall Street movement would learn from Scientology and become like a cult-like religion that aggressively defends itself, brutally puts down its enemies, surveils everybody. And I thought, what he's describing there is
the Bolshevik Revolution.
Right. He's describing the Russian Revolution. He's describing communism.
He wants Lenin. That's what he wants.
Right. But besides, beyond what he wants, I thought the idea was interesting. And it certainly made me think of the NSA. And it certainly made me think of, well, you know, we tend to recoil and say, oh my God, you know, those kinds of things. When you know, when I imagine gulags and brutality and aggressively taking away free speech, I imagine this horrific, a totalitarian place that we would most likely go to war over in the 20th century. But the United States is turning into, or is being revealed, not turning into, but is being revealed to be exactly that kind of force. Now, obviously, we don't have labor camps yet, and we're not in that place. And this podcast is not about, like, screaming.
We have prisons.
Screaming in an Alex Jones kind of way, but you're right.
The prisons are the labor camps, and Alex Jones can't acknowledge that because his audience is racist.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So there's a lot going on there, but the idea that we already kind of live in that totalitarian regime.
Yeah, and our labor camps are built on the basis that you're a bad person, mm-hmm. not on the basis of ethnicity or any kind of racial characteristics. You know, it's like we're not putting people in there because they're Black and Hispanic. We're targeting Blacks and Hispanics for being bad Blacks and Hispanics, and then putting them in these camps, which are torture chambers and which contain all various kinds of torture, and also which are labor camps where there's no minimum wage enforced and it's a form of neo-slavery. But I want to get back to one thing.
It's a bizarre thing that we pat ourselves on the back for the things we don't do. You know, like we're not the Nazis. You know, we never rounded up Jews and put them in camps.
It's all about
and burn them to death.
About the vocabulary you use.
We weren't racist like the Nazis, but the reality is that the United States, I think, was practicing eugenics decades before the Nazis
And remember, the Nazis were held to account by an outside tribunal. The United States never has.
Whenever we get to the Nazis, we go way off track, but you were saying something.
Well, I'd really like your point about the NSA is a church. Mm-hmm. And that there's a certain way that when these institutions get formed, they become cult-like and they enforce their own belief systems through violence. And that they are by definition paranoid and by definition protective. And, you know, there's...
Well, at this point, I mean, just to back that up, when people might say it sounds paranoid to say that the NSA and the state is backing itself up by violence, but I would just point out to the idea that if anyone were to really organize against this kind of stuff, we've seen the militarization of police forces be unveiled over not only the course of Occupy Wall Street, but through the drug war and everything else, and the acceleration of that has been stark. And I don't know if I told you this, but when I was in Ventura, California, while I was there just over the summer, I saw a Ventura Police Department armored vehicle of some kind that was obviously brand new. It was obviously very expensive, and I've never seen anything like it in this small... Ventura is a small town, and Ventura now has a police force with things that the military has.
Future show police state.
Yeah, and so when you say the NSA backed up by threats of violence, I think of the ideas of what we just saw just this last week with Walmart protests happening around the country, all met with tear gas. And I mean, it was really out of Homestead.
That's what makes the Chelsea Manning trial so important. It's all there.
It's tied together.
Yes. Yeah. I want to react to that comment for a couple more reasons. Though one, he sounds like a Leninist, which is funny, I guess, especially if you're joking about it. Two, I'm not a Bolshevik. I would never want to be part of a social movement that used force that way. I'm just that's another show.
Yeah.
Number three, the kind of church-like belief system that he's riffing on with Scientology, and we might be riffing on with the NSA, is interesting because that was the old vital center liberal critique of communism, which is that it was its own religion with sacred fathers and sacred texts and mm-hmm. sacred belief systems, which were oversimplified for a populace that was militantly believing in a utopia. And in some sense, that was true for some eras, some places. But I also want to just kind of say one thing about what Snowden means to Occupy Wall Street, because I think that they're going to be written together.
And
one of the ways that I think they'll be written together is that...
Yeah, they'll be written together with, it would be like you said, I think Occupy, Anonymous, WikiLeaks, yep. Manning, Snowden.
It's definitely...
And will continue.
It will continue.
I think we're seeing the creation of a new kind of global political landscape that has, the war is going to be fought on a digital terrain.
Exactly. We're going through.
Tells you how much information has always been a part of this.
We're going through the political effects of the digital revolution. Mm. We're just now seeing the unintended consequences of the rise of the internet played out within national and international politics. Mm. And what I want to say, though, specifically about Snowden and Occupy Wall Street even more further, is that there was a relative success to Occupy, and that's, we can do a show called, the relative success of Occupy.
Right.
But what I want to point out here is that Edward Snowden, one man with information, very crucial information from inside the state machine, was able to effect extraordinary radical changes within the belief system of the American and international public, and I think this is true, possibly bring down the Obama administration. I think that a lot of what's happened to Obama was nailed by the Snowden scandal. Mm. I think the Snowden thing just exposed Obama as the biggest hypocritical liberal bullshitter, and it exposed him very, very suddenly and caught him off guard.
Right, you say that specifically because Obama campaigned on a
mythology of being anti-Bush.
But also on behaving in exactly opposite the way that he
government.
Right that he behaved around the Snowden case.
That's right, and so
the Snowden case revealed Obama to really not have the conviction or whatever to be able to follow through on what he promised.
That's right.
And obviously that's been, I would say, kind of the narrative of the Obama administration for the last 6 years. But at the same time, the Snowden thing was probably the crowning moment of that phenomenon. Snowden really put his principles to the test, and he failed.
Snowden is to Obama what Cindy Sheehan was to Bush. Mm. The one figure who came out of nowhere to show that this person's immoral,
yeah,
and that this person's a liar,
right,
and that this person's is a bad person, quote unquote. So
again, remembering that presidents are just
right. Following my own advice, I can't put it all on a bottom. Thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to say, though, in comparison to Occupy, though, is that what Snowden has done and what Manning has done is show that you can effectively create social political consequences without a social movement.
Yeah.
And maybe Snowden and Manning are indivisible from Occupy and related contexts like that, and they are part of a political movement, but they don't come out and say we did this to be part of Occupy. If anything, they both have an affiliation for WikiLeaks as an international global movement about digital transparency.
Right.
But what that tells me, as someone who has studied American social movements, and for me who's concerned with what's happened and how we're different from the civil rights movement, and how I don't even know if you could produce an effective civil rights movement to this day. But if you were to do that, we need people to flip who are already on the inside of the machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Manning and Snowden have showed us that the way to get the elite to pay attention and the way to structure political reform is not through civil rights style crowd pressure, at least not yet.
It's to be a rat for the people.
Yep, it's to be a whistleblower.
Yeah.
And so what this tells us is how far the digital revolution has transformed domestic American politics, but it's also showed us that in a country that is showing overt totalitarian impulses within the context of what we might call a two-party democratic republic, in that perverted, distorted political sphere where there isn't any label for what we're living through, one of the weapons, quote-unquote, that are available to people to try to expose the concentration of corporate and government power in terms of these centralized forces for what they are is that you have to actually be a mole from the very beginning, and to turn institutions inside out, and that maybe because of the police state, maybe because of the prison gulag system, maybe because of other things, you can't actually produce an effective social movement at this time through physical force. Not that you ever could have, but even through nonviolent physical force. I mean, Occupy Wall Street.
Through the labor camp with you.
What we need to do is to produce a climate of public opinion where people who are in positions that Snowden was in feel comfortable coming out.
Mm. We have to create a cultural shift. We always come back to kind of changing our minds and changing what's acceptable even morally on a mass scale. And that's something that's hard to achieve. I think that's why religion seems to be interesting to me, because religion is a force and maybe the largest institution for creating cultural change around morality. But at the same time, there are so many problems with the structures of religion, particularly in the United States right now, and the impact on politics that I would never suggest that the solution to our problem is religion. But at the same time, I think there's a battle to be fought at least rhetorically, and ultimately, I think practically, about this kind of morality.
A couple more points I want to hit here based off of this. Number one is, on a personal note, what it tells you is that it's more important for you to reform the institution you're a part of at work than it is for you to participate in a social movement. That you have more power at your job at a corporation, at your job working for a university. There is more power now in exposing the corruption of our obviously corrupt political, public, and private institutions. I mean, I think that's a big story that I've been thinking about for years now. I've been collecting newspaper articles on it. I think one of the key points that isn't part of the public narrative that should be, that I think will be part of the historic narrative, is that our institutions are corrupt.
Yeah.
That they're exploited for personal gain, and there's graft, and there's all kinds of stuff, and that people enough of our institutions are dominated by people who are kind of in it for themselves, and they're in it to please their higher ups, and that we have a lot more in common with the Chinese state corporations and with the old Soviet Union than I think we like to think. I think the other point that I just want to hit there is, besides where our personal power might lay, which is both part of social movements, like I say, but really as part of inside reforms for institutions and taking real risks at work, where the real risks have to be taken, I think, is also just a point of saying that we've never had the creation of a new agency within the executive branch that has ever gone away. That these institutions are self-propelled bureaucratic machines, and they need a reason to exist, and they will find enemies even if there aren't any, because you can never say that here's an agency with a budget of $10 billion, we're going to end it, it's over. There will only be the need to create more agencies, and
it's self-sustaining, and that's what is kind of seems impossible about the whole project of shifting the institution, or even destroying it and creating a new one. Realizing that the new institution is gonna have this nature and have this kind of ontology as well, right? That it's gonna create its own power for its own sake, and it's gonna continue on. You can become very cynical about institutions when you start thinking that way. One thing that I wanted to maybe end on, because I've kept you talking despite your cough for a little bit here, is that we can back to local politics. As I did mention stop and frisk at the beginning of this hour, we're in the midst of a mayoral election in New York City. We've talked a lot about New York City on this podcast, and in particular we talked a lot about Bloomberg and how his policies have changed New York City, particularly the policy of stop and frisk. So there's an interesting kind of thing happening where it seems like this, at least during the primaries already in this mayoral election, with Bloomberg finally giving up after how many years has he been in? Is it 9 years? Something like that.
I want to say 12.
12 years.
2001 to 2013.
Yeah, you're right. 12 years. It seems like the election is becoming a referendum on stop and frisk and on a lot of those policies. At least what stop and frisk seems
and housing.
Stop and frisk seems to be more than stop and frisk. The policy itself seems to represent that kind of two cities thing that Bill de Blasio, who's
That's
the
true.
Leading candidate, is talking about. Leading candidate for the Democrats is Bill de Blasio, who Bloomberg attacked yesterday, and Bloomberg attacked him. We were both laughing about it because of the absurdity of it. But Bloomberg attacked de Blasio, saying that de Blasio is running a racist campaign by displaying his family. De Blasio is married to a black woman, and their son is of mixed race, obviously. And Bloomberg says just by displaying his family, he's being racist, which is amazing considering that Bloomberg is responsible for arguably one of the largest expansions of racist police powers in U.S. history. When Bloomberg attacked De Blasio yesterday in this interview, this is the quote I wanted to read, and I wanted to just get your reaction to it, but kind of see where we're at with what's happening in New York. This is Bloomberg saying, de Blasio's whole campaign is that, I'm not going to do Bloomberg's accent, by the way. Bloomberg says, de Blasio's whole campaign is that there are two different cities here, and I've never liked that kind of division. The way to help those who are less fortunate is, number one, to attract more very fortunate people. They are the ones that pay the bills. The people that would get very badly hurt here if you drive out the very wealthy are the people he professes to try to help. Tearing people apart with this two cities thing doesn't make any sense to me. It's a destructive strategy for those you want to help the most. He's a very populist, very left-wing guy, but this city is not two groups. And if to some extent it is, it's one group paying for services for the other. What do you think of Bloomberg's vision there?
I mean, what an awesome quote. I mean, that sums up, first of all, 150 years of classical liberal thinking on the economy. It sums up the last 30 years of the war on drugs thinking that, you know, kind of, if you even want to say, the Reagan era and the post-Reagan era.
It's kind of got this, he reveals his, like, elite paternalism very, very clearly.
And I just want to unpack a couple things there, because, I mean, it's one of those things where, for me to take it seriously would be to lose my Vulcan veneer.
Right.
to the extent that's possible. And so here's what's on the table for me. One, there's a game that's being played here where liberals and conservatives combine to create social, economic, political systems in race-neutral terms that have racially and ethnic-specific effects. And then when the people from neighborhoods or their politicians, representatives, etc., start to complain in the terms of the effects of those systems, which are racially charged and ethnically charged, the liberal who prides himself on producing a social, political, economic system in non-racial ethnic terms, post-civil rights, then claims they're the ones that are being racist. Mm-hmm. So under that same logic, to say that the criminal justice system has institutionalized racial and ethnic prejudice, and that's why the prison population is what it is, or the same thing with the war on drugs, you would then get accused by, in this case, Bloomberg, for being racist.
Right.
Or another thing would be thinking to say, Bloomberg's economic principles, which rest on the racially neutral idea that rich people spend money, which produce services, which produces, this is Reagan economics,
right,
trickle down effects. Then when that produces, obviously when that produces inequality, the people who complain about the inequality it produces are accused of class warfare. And it's a rhetorical game, and it's one of those, it's a codependent, it's sick and twisted.
And we've kind of talked about it on this show in terms of, in the context of gentrification, right, where we've seen, these kind of global firms moving in and building giant luxury skyscrapers that exclude pretty much anyone that's not in the 1%, becoming the kind of norm of construction and cultural patterns in the way that Manhattan and now Brooklyn is moving. Do you see that changing under de Blasio? It feels like, I mean, I know, I don't want to get into the specific politics here, but it seems like de Blasio, as much as he is kind of seen as a kind of larger, maybe liberal repudiation of Bloomberg's authority, at the same time, de Blasio doesn't seem like he's exactly a revolutionary candidate in terms of shifting the overall dynamic of what's going on in New York.
I think that the most practical...
And I'm talking about those bigger socioeconomic things.
I think the most practical thing de Blasio can do is to follow through in his, you know, preschool daycare. What that used to be called... sewer socialism, back when Victor Berger was mayor of Milwaukee and he was a Socialist Party mayor. This is back when the Socialist Party had, you know, fielded candidates across the country, and they, you know, they did little things like building the sewers to make the quality of life, the standard of living better. And, you know, I think he'll probably be able to get that done, depending on how many votes he's able to, you know, to get from the city council and whoever else is supposed to vote on that. I also think, though, that he's going to run into big problems, and this is where I think people, you know, Quinn supporters have a point, and I'm not taking sides here. I'm really not. And I could be wrong, is that no one who is part of the old guard city elite is going to cooperate with de Blasio past a certain point. So he's going to have to figure out a way to rhetorically satisfy the people that put him into power while at the same time compromising with the people that really run the city, because the mayor is the victim, same as the president, which is to say he's responsible for managing and negotiating with a matrix of powers, but he is not in charge. And so he's going to have to find ways to cut deals, and that those deals will be a different world than the deals that Bloomberg would have cut, but they're not going to be revolutionary because the position itself is not a revolutionary position.
Well, at the same time, Bloomberg has exhibited a tremendous influence on the city. It's definitely, you know, the end of an era when he goes away, and has left an indelible impression, and you know, according to the New York Times, a very positive and glowing, majestic impression. Although I would say his legacy will probably end up being a lot more complex than that.
Well, and I just want to say a word about his complex legacy. You know, what Bloomberg did there was campaign style rhetoric. You know, like he's smarter than that. I don't like him per se, but he's not that stupid to make that argument about the oligarchs. The Russian oligarchs should come to New York and spend all their money. And we'd have more jobs. And the reason he doesn't believe that is because he's the one working with Cornell to set up that new university for technological innovation and incubation on Roosevelt Island or wherever that place is.
Right.
Governor's Island. I don't remember where it is.
Right.
But he's actually saying that one of the keys to the New York economy is as an incubation hub for leading tech companies. Now, that's about producing in a new economy through innovation. That's not a trickle-down service sector economy serving like butlers to the global 1%.
He did leave the Republican Party. He's an independent.
But it shows
he is somewhat of an anomalous political figure in a sense that he kind of plays all sides.
Yes. Yes.
He's a boss tweed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we should have a longer kind of conversation about that, the Bloomberg legacy at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just wanted to say that because I don't think he actually believes what he was saying to a certain point. I think what it tells me, though, is that emotionally he believes it. And then when we're talking about emotions, we're losing the logic, which means, well, why does he need to believe that? I think he needs to believe that for his own personal reasons, given his own career and political trajectory. When he's saying that stuff about the oligarchs, he's talking about himself. He's an American oligarch, and he's tried to create a local and even national, even global economy in his image, where I think when he goes to bed at night, he doesn't think I'm serving my Bloomberg machines are serving the Wall Street elite and that's why I'm a good person.
Right, right.
He thinks my billion-dollar company has provided jobs for thousands of talented people, and that's my true legacy, and that's actually why he wanted to be mayor. And I think that before I end on this, I'll just say I think that set of contradictions, that messy emotional rhetoric that's about political economy, is the defining confusion of what it means to be a liberal.
Interesting stuff. I always enjoy your cold, reptilian, logical, realistic view on what's going on globally and locally and nationally. We've got some big stuff happening right now. I continue to be fascinated by the way that information specifically is changing the way that the global politics works, meaning that things are flowing in a very different way. It seems like there are multiple narratives happening at once, and to be able to disentangle those narratives takes a little bit of not only intellectual effort, but just kind of, I would say, intuition. It's getting to the point where you have to become kind of an oracle to figure out what's happening. So it's great to try and speculate about what the motivations of all these actors are with you. So thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. I hope we can continue the conversation soon.
For sure. See you next time.